Chapter 19. Dreadful News. For a week, Yuk was right about the attack. Nothing happened. After the rodents disappeared into the fields, Drat's soldiers went back to their regular posts, which had been assigned by Bombu and Zerni, with the small exception of adding a few more men at the entrance to their camp. Silong didn't like the decision to hold off on distributing swords, so he continued to use his powers of persuasion, attempting to convince his pupils that they should insist on swording up. For that purpose, he reopened training and held unusually long hours, welcoming everyone that had studied under him before. He even included Bu, despite their running conflict, and he had his subjects dueling with spar swords, working to make them feel more confident in their abilities. The swordplay bonanza was as encompassing and contagious as the Belurse binge had been. Other areas of Twistyard also felt an increase in participation. By demand, Tinja held 3 practice classes daily in Hatu. Strat held an intense course in defense and mobility with Schiltz, and Ascertani was constrained to begin a lecture series on the history of traditional attacking methods. Pots, Lings, and Kusings all felt an increased need to be prepared in the event of an assault, for the rodent episode had shown them that with ease, an enemy could create enough chaos to dismantle the guarding Drat forces. Not to mention, it proved someone or some group of people were engaged in mischief against Twistyard, beyond idle threats. Dilly loved the extra time spent practicing swordplay. She felt it was useful in preparing for a possible meeting with the Dread, while also serving her primary purpose of improving her skills, hoping to make a mark against Rahl in the upcoming tournaments. Sani was even persuaded to join in. She decided that things were bad enough to justify taking a momentary break from books in order to revamp her fencing abilities. Boot, Buck, and Dodd also took part in the exercises. However, Dodd purposefully avoided all dueling and mostly engaged his practice against trees and fences on the outskirts of Sir Lunk's large classes. He knew he had a long way to go before he would be prepared enough to not make a complete fool of himself in a real duel, so he worked hard on being as invisible as possible. Eventually, though, he couldn't hide. There was sufficient bad blood between him and Saab's mob of followers from Rahl that a confrontation was inevitable. "Hey, come back!" yelled Saab, late one morning when he noticed Dodd was heading out of the crowd. "Let's see if you're as good as everyone says you are. I challenge you." Dodd froze in his tracks. Sweat began to form on the sides of his brow. He was holding the slender limb of an elm because there were so many students in Sir Lunk's overinflated classes that everyone had to rotate with the spar swords in shifts. "Sorry," Dodd responded without making eye contact. "It's my turn to use a stick. You'll need to find someone else to fight. I'll be over here practicing with the bulrush bush." "Did you hear that joke?" "Dodd needs a sword," said Saab condescendingly to his friend. "You've made a pig of yourself already. Go stick for a while. Or better yet, watch me jilt the bookards out of Dodd. You'll learn a few things." Saab grabbed Joke's sword and in the process pushed a number of people out of his way. It caused commotion that turned heads instantly. "Get him, Dodd," yelled Toose. "Show him how Pap would have done it." Another boy named Scott, a Sushling twig that resembled Jim, was big-eyed with excitement when he hollered, "Everyone come and see! Dodd and Saab are striking a duel! Now Rahl can swig a cupful of their own poison!" "You wish," snarled Quit, leaving Saab's side momentarily to shove the boy to the ground. With Quit's giant frame, it was like a professional wrestler picking on a 12-year-old. "The day anyone from Green beats Saab," said Quit gruffly, "is the day I fancy up and prance the halls like Eluxa." "Then go find a skirt," said Scott defiantly, scurrying across the ground on his knees. He didn't dare rise until he was safely at Dodd's side. Eluxa, hearing her name, climbed on a stump to see better and posed with her spar sword over her shoulder. The crowd stopped slicing and whacking, and in a remarkably short period of time they formed a large circle around the feud. Even Sir Lonk, the great sword instructor, had to push in order to have a front row spot. Saab tossed Joke's sword to the ground at Dodd's feet and said, "Show me what you've got." He then glanced at his followers and grinned, raising his own sword in the air, evoking cheers. "I don't feel like it right now," said Dodd quietly. He turned his back on Saab in an attempt to retreat into the crowd, but couldn't find an opening. The wall of people was teeth tight. "What? You don't feel like it?" mocked Saab loudly. "You're scared to duel against me, and it's only practice. We're using spar swords. You can't possibly get hurt. What are you afraid of, coward?" "What are you afraid of?" demanded Dilly, who stepped into the circle behind Sob. "I've been asking for a match all week, and you've hid like a snake in a rat's hole. If you're finally able to duel, Dodd's going to have to wait in line behind me. I'm first." Dilly was a rescuing angel. She alone knew Dodd's weakness, how poorly he handled a sword, and she cared enough to help him keep it a secret. "Step aside," said Dilly to Joke and Quit, who jumped between her and Sob. "You might want to make yourselves comfortable. I plan on a full match. We're going to need some space." Dilly turned her head for a moment, pointing the way for Joke and Quit to exit, when something horrible happened. Smack! In a cruel act, lacking any sportsmanship, Sob struck the broadside of his retractable sword across Dilly's right hand while she wasn't looking. It made a strident sound, followed by Dilly's wailing. The point of impact was against her four fingers that held her sword, and the blow was hard enough to incapacitate her from dueling. She dropped to her knees and grabbed at her throbbing fingers. "Get this baby out of the circle," said Sob to Joke and Quit. "I don't have time to hear her whining. Dot and I have unfinished business to attend to." Sob spoke with arrogance as if he were the greatest of swordsmen, yet the act he had just performed was anything but great. It was a cheap, low-down, scoundrel, scumbag, maggot-sucking, unfair blow. Or at least those were some of the thoughts that ran through Dodd's mind. He looked to Sir Lonk for intervention, hoping what Sob had just done was deplorable enough to have Sob be disciplined on the spot. However, to Dodd's astonishment, Sir Lonk seemed to enjoy the riotous atmosphere and didn't show the slightest indication of objection. On the contrary, he appeared to be proud of his brother's son. It was the last straw. A moment Dodd had considered many times had come. He had planned on being abused by bullies to the extent that physical contact was imminent, since they ran their mouths constantly in his face, threatening to do plenty. But now that the moment had arrived, it was filled with more emotion and conviction than he had ever imagined. It was Dodd's worst-case scenario. Hitting Dilly with a blind shot while she was trying to stick up for him, and then having Sir Lonk condone it was infuriating. It made the blood run so fast through Dodd's head that he could hear it pounding in his ears, and the noise it caused was loud enough to entirely drown out the crowd of shouting people. Without saying a word, Dodd scooped Joke's sword from the ground and marched straight for Sob. "It's nice to see that you've changed your mind," said Sob, gloating. "Here now, let's test what you know." Sob raised his sword and swung it around in the air, giving a fancy show of ability, and then pointed it directly at Dodd. When the move didn't even register a response in Dodd's undeterred eyes, Sob uncomfortably added, "I'll have you for lunch. You're a nobody." Dodd continued to march forward. He didn't hear what Sob had to say, nor did he care, for his rage was beyond reasoning. The encounter was brief enough to be missed by anyone who blinked. When Dodd was within striking range, Sob leaned in and jabbed with his sword, poking Dodd's right shoulder. Fortunately, the spar sword retracted, as expected, causing no more harm to Dodd than a pinch, but that was only a side note to the real action. Sob was so busy concentrating on proving how good he was at swordplay that he entirely missed the serious nature of Dodd's intent. When Sob struck, Dodd was lifting Joke's sword with his right hand, pretending to duel. However, rather than focusing on blocking the jab, Dodd put all of his attention into swinging a powerful left punch. It connected solidly with Sob's arrogant nose, sending him to the ground. Over the years, Cole had prepared to defend himself with his fists, and though he had always hoped he would never be forced into a position where he would actually need to use them, he had practiced a quick left hook, reserved exclusively for such a day. In his plan, if he were ever attacked, he would distract with his right fist while hitting hard enough with his left to stop the conflict cold, or at least give himself time to retreat. And with Sob, it worked perfectly. Blood ran down Sob's face from his nose as he struggled to pull himself up to a sitting position. His eyes were angry, showing he wanted to fight back. Yet they also revealed he was too scared to stand up, partially because of what had just happened, but more than that because of Dodd's reputation. After all, Dodd was Pap's grandson, and he was mad. "I thought I made myself clear," growled Dodd in his roughest voice, glaring sternly at Sob. "I don't feel like dueling right now. Maybe some other time." Dodd threw Joke's sword into Sob's lap and added, shaking his clenched fist at him, "If you ever treat a girl like that again, any girl, you'll be sorry. Mark my words. I want to see you start showing some respect for women. Do I make myself clear? Sob stared, cold and glazed, fighting the urge to rise up. He didn't nod or say anything to Dodd, but the swooning of a dozen girls from Rawl, who found Dodd's words heroic, left Sob the pathetic loser. Even Eluxa played her best eyes in Dodd's direction, flipping her silky hair out of her face, hoping to attract his attention. Dodd, on the other hand, had someone else on his mind. He walked over to where Dilly was still whimpering, holding her fingers. Jokin quit, saw him coming, and abruptly let go of her, vanishing into the crowd of spectators as quickly as they could, making it clear that they didn't want to be the next in line to feel Dodd's wrath. "Come on, Dilly," said Dodd, putting his arm around her. "I think it's lunchtime." Boot, Buck, Sonny Toos, and all of the other green coosings and greenlings rushed to surround the twosome as they left the class, like a swarm of bees, protecting their queen. "Make sure you come back later," encouraged Sir Lonk in an exalted voice. "All of that hot energy is ideal for swordplay. Good show to you all." In the grand kitchen, Mercy and Sonny attended to Dilly's fingers with ice, while the others from Green Hall went to save the best tables for lunch. Dilly's fingers had swollen up and were starting to show a black and blue line where Sob's sword had struck. "What a weasel," responded Mercy when she heard what Sob had done to Dilly. She pulled a tray of roasted chickens from the oven and set them out to cool, all the while shaking her head in disgust. "Sob's been afraid to duel you fair and square ever since you made it a priority to be the best," she continued loudly, gaveling the daylights out of a slab of raw beef. "He knows you're going to beat him in the tournaments this year, if it's an equitable match. That's why he uses deplorable moves like the trash he pulled today. He hopes you'll stay clear of his title." Mercy waved her wooden hammer in the air, plunging in forcefully. "And mind you, I expect you won't." "He's better than you think," lamented Dilly somberly, rotating the ice across her fingers. "Sob? Sob? Are we talking about the same Sob?" blurted Mercy, getting worked up enough that many of the kitchen helpers grabbed at loaded platters and headed out of the room. "Yes, Mercy. He's a rat, but he's good at swordplay. Nobody would dispute that he's the best in Rawl Hall, and they're the best in the castle." "Don't forget about the greats," chimed Mercy, throwing a 50-pound, well-tenderized hunk of beef onto a flaming grill using two giant forks. The juicy meat sizzled and sent smoke billowing up to where a tuba-sized duct remarkably sucked it all out of the room. "Of course some of the greats are better," admitted Dilly. Sonny nodded too. "And I see you as one of them," interrupted Mercy passionately, grabbing at a leg's length spoon with a top nearly the size of her head. She bent down and stirred vigorously a bathtub-like cauldron of soup that bubbled over a pit in the floor flame. "Don't forget that you're Bombu's great-granddaughter," she added, beginning to huff and sweat. "And he calls you great for more than one reason." I know," said Dilly, wincing a little as Sonny inspected the bruises that were darkening across her fingers. "He says that a lot," continued Dilly, "but it's candy talk, not real." "I beg to differ," insisted Mercy adamantly. She stomped her foot on the floor and poised for emphasis, holding up the dripping spoon and bellowed, "This is your house, girl! Sob and the rest of those disrespectful smudges of soot are not welcome if they insult the very princess of the palace. Well, princesses, you too, Sonny." Including Sonny in the conversation led to the rest of the story. She smiled ear to ear and then said with delight, "I suppose Sob won't need any lunch since he's already had a bite to eat." "He has?" asked Mercy, sensing there was more. "Yes, we forgot to tell you," Sonny continued. "Dodd gave him a knuckle sandwich. It was solid on his nose, made the blood run and everything." "I should like to have seen his face," chirped Dilly, starting to revive as the ice numbed the pain. "He was, unfortunately, facing away from me. You'd think Dodd could have flipped him around when knocking him to the ground. What kind of gentleman is he, anyway?" Dilly and Sonny both chuckled pleasantly. Mercy was also pleased, having heard the beginning of a tale she knew they would need to dwell on. As the story unfolded in its every particular, Mercy continued to listen and add her plentiful thoughts while cooking for thousands and directing the dispersal of food through men and women under her charge. At one point, Boot poked his head in the room to ask why the girls weren't coming to join the rest of the group, since lunch was already underway. Yet when he saw Mercy holding them hostage, and the girls did look amused by the things she said, he silently slipped away before being trapped with them. The Great Hall was bustling with working people. In addition to the lunchtime rush, many draughts were climbing ladders to hang ornate decorations from the ceiling. They were preparing for the following morning's celebration, observing Rainfall Day. Olive Green showed respect for Rainfall Day, as much or more than Americans show for Thanksgiving. The two holidays actually had a lot in common. They both revolved around giving thanks for the blessings of life and friendship, and they both celebrated the abundance of food by feasting. When Boot returned to eat his lunch, he found his spot was taken by a draught who was steadying one end of a giant A-frame ladder. The man apologized profusely to Boot for interrupting, and then promised they would hurry as fast as they could. "Don't think another thing of it," said Boot cheerfully, reaching around the ladder and man to grab a bite of lunch. "I can eat standing as well as sitting. I'm talented that way. There's no need to relax my lower end in order to digest properly." The draught thanked Boot and smiled, though he appeared uncomfortable. "Can I help you with that?" asked Boot, noticing the ladder was starting to sway. "I'm not too bad at posting up." "Except the time you sent me flying in Gramps' apple orchard," said Buck, reminding Boot of his poorly executed prank. "I was only joking around, no harm done." "Actually, my broken leg and I didn't find it very funny," said Buck, grinning. "That's because you jumped," said Boot, grabbing at more of his lunch. "I was just making the ladder shake. Like a little burp in the ground. If you would have held on, you'd have been fine." "I did hold on," blurted Buck, his voice cracking momentarily. "I held on to a 20-pound bucket of apples, and it didn't help me stay perched very well." "Don't listen to him," said Boot to the worker. "Let me help you with that." Boot grabbed the ladder firmly, and the swaying stopped. A muscular treader was climbing the other side with an unusual leather ornament. It was large and painted bright red, with a few white streaks. "That's the biggest apple I've ever seen," said Toose, pointing to the strange object. "It was 3 feet in diameter." "Then you've never seen the big apple before, have you?" joked Dodd. "What big apple?" asked Donchie sweetly, turning her bright blue eyes on Dodd. Apparently, the scuffle with Sob outside had spun Donchie's favorable gaze in Dodd's direction. She was hopelessly crushed out, like a lost puppy who had just discovered a pair of loving, safe arms and a warm meal. "A city I know of has the nickname Big Apple," responded Dodd quickly, blushing. It had nothing to do with what she had said and everything to do with the way she had said it. "Oh," said Donchie admiringly, doing her best to weasel her tray of food closer to Dodd's. Small talk and eating continued as the treader on the ladder attempted to hang the gigantic ornament. It dangled precariously over Boot's head. "Boot, I'd move if I were you," recommended Pone from a table away. He was filling his mouth with a chicken leg. Boot grinned at Pone, thinking about Buck's impersonations of him. "What?" asked Boot, pretending he hadn't heard. Boot hoped to draw Pone into saying more with the stuffed mouth. He glanced at Buck and raised his eyebrows. "You should move," said Pone. "What?" asked Boot, putting his hand up to his ear. "That apple might not stick," said Pone loudly, chewing away. He plopped a clump of grapes in with the half a roll he was already working on, and while spinning his hand in the air, said through his food, "Perhaps you could steady the ladder from a different angle." Toose Juck and many of the other greenlings laughed. They recognized what Boot was doing. "He's right," interjected Dodd, feeling uncomfortable. "You really should move." Dodd noticed that the strong man hanging the ornament appeared to be groaning. "Oh, I'm not afraid of a leather apple," snickered Boot, perfectly relaxed. He jammed a handful of carrot sticks into his mouth and did his own impersonation of Pone, making a crunching sound as he said calmly, "It's just a decoration." The greenlings and coosings roared, very amused by Boot's tableside entertainment. Pone, recognizing Boot's play, joined in the laughter and then did a perfect impersonation of Boot, with a flawless display of his posture and speech, which made the crowd go wild. Pone was a fun-loving master of the masquerade. Suddenly, disaster struck. As soon as the treader at the top of the ladder had hitched the apple to a metal loop, it broke free and came crashing down. Boot didn't flinch when he heard Pone yell, "Watch out!" Instead, full of the fun atmosphere, he stood up straighter to make a point of his fearless nature and to continue pleasing his spectators. After all, it was only a leather ball of sorts. The apple fell 30 feet from the ceiling. However, before it hit the crown of Boot's head, Buck jumped to his feet and vigorously tackled his brother, sending them both flying. Crash! When the ornament hit the ground, it burst open and rocks littered the great hall floor. A gaping dent scarred the polished stone where the apple had struck. "Rocks?" gasped Boot, completely shocked. "That could have killed me. Who put rocks in that thing?" "I'll be bush trimmed to the roots," muttered the drat who had steadied the ladder. "No wonder we were having such a hard time. I'm going to personally find out who's at the bottom of this prank. It could have seriously injured someone." The workmen left the ladder in place and the shattered ornament on the floor while they went to investigate. "Thanks, Buck," said Boot in a very serious and grateful voice. "You're the best brother anyone could ever ask for." "I'm just protecting my space," said Buck teasingly. "If you were gone, Dot and I would eventually give in and our bedroom would be filled with half a dozen other Koosings. But with you around, I know that won't happen." "Right," said Boot. "I'm sure that's why you did it." A crowd of people started gathering around them. They left their own lunches to come over and see what had caused the loud crashing sound. Even Mercy, followed by Dilly and Sonny, came running. Their chit-chatting could wait. "How did this happen?" asked a large, red-faced drat named Scuttle, who was the chief gardener at Twistyard. His spiky hair and well-trimmed beard were graying white, and his massive chest stretched his shirt tight in the center as he breathed in and out, trying to calm down. At 6.5 feet, he towered above the other workers and commanded a great deal of respect. When nobody came forward to explain, he searched his personnel with his mud-brown eyes, glancing around the room at everyone wearing the purple-collared uniforms. "Zerny's not going to like this," he muttered under his breath. "I said, how did this happen?" barked Scuttle. This time he was loud enough to be easily heard by all of his subordinates. They came scampering to him, looking nervous. "While they were hanging the decoration, it fell," responded Boot, feeling awkward that he hadn't said anything yet. "It almost hit me on the head, and I didn't wobble the ladder, I promise. You can ask anyone." Boot was so accustomed to being in trouble when trouble happened around him that it was strange to honestly retell the event without taking the blame. "Would you please identify the men who were working this ladder?" said Scuttle firmly. "Sure. It was, let's see," said Boot, scanning the crowd of faces. Scuttle's men stood ready for inspection and instruction. When Boot didn't readily see the twosome, he pushed Buck's lunch to the side and climbed on the table to get a better view. Still, the men weren't in sight. "There was a large treader on the ladder," Boot began, when Scuttle jumped in. "Treader? We're all drats," said Scuttle, wearing a most peculiar expression. "Are you sure it was a treader?" Boot instantly noticed that he recognized the other members of the decoration crew. They were Twistyard gardening hands and stablemen. "Didn't you hire any outsiders to help with today's preparations?" asked Boot. "No, we certainly didn't," said Scuttle. "If you saw a treader on the ladder, we've got a problem. This was done on purpose." "He was a treader," said Buck, adding his testimony to his brother's, "and I don't believe I've ever seen him around here before. Did anyone else recognize him?" The crowd stayed silent, wagging their heads side to side. Rigorous attempts were thereafter made to apprehend the mystery men. Sadly, nobody was able to find them. Their escape had been well planned. Drat forces doubled their efforts and increased precautions after the event, but it was too late to catch the perpetrators. Yuk was concerned with the disruption and breach of security, so he too became actively involved in the investigation, interviewing Boot, Buck, and Dodd separately, as well as riding his beloved mare through the neighboring forests, trying to find the fleeing criminals. All of the efforts were in vain. By dinner time, messengers were sent to surrounding villages warning them of trouble causers and canceling their prior invitation to join at Twistyard for a breakfast party to celebrate Rainfall Day. If unknown faces brought danger, the safest way to avoid further attacks was to monitor all guests carefully. Even the current visitors at Twistyard, especially the short-stayed diplomats and nobles, were all accounted for, noted, and warned, leaving no room for an uninvited guest to slip into the crowd without being identified. Also, in light of additional secret news, Yuk held a private meeting concerning another issue. He refused to make the information public. Nevertheless, it seemed to stir things up amongst the greats that were present. Directly following the brief gathering, a group of four people, including Yuk, Sirlonk, Strat, and Tinja, headed for the barns, leaving in such a rush that they didn't stop to eat dinner. When Dilly and Sonny saw them hurrying, they left their food and followed. "What's going on?" asked Dilly, chasing a spiffier-than-usual Strat. He had a fresh haircut, his customary chin and lip stubble were gone, and he wore polished new boots that matched his splurgy outfit. To look at him, You would think it was the night he was being honored as the best Belurs coach in all of Green. "I wish I could tell you, but I can't," said Strat, moving with purpose. "If you want to know, you'll have to ask Uke directly. He made us all promise to keep it a secret." Dilly looked around and couldn't see Uke. "Where is he?" she begged, jogging to keep up. "His mare is over in the overgrown pasture. You know, the one where we used to keep the spring colts," said Strat, pointing to a field just beyond the row of barns. Trees and bushes hid Uke and his horse from view. "He wanted her to get fresh feed after returning from today's search," he said. "Come on, Strat, please just tell us," nagged Dilly persistently. "We won't share it with anyone else. We promise." Strat stopped and shook his head, his solemn brown eyes penetrating to the girls' hearts. "If it were only a matter of keeping a secret, I would tell you both. But because of the promise I've made, it's now a matter of my honor. You know I can't change that." Dilly and Sonny followed Strat into the barn, wishing he could at least give them a hint. Sirlonk and Tinja were leading in the front, a few paces ahead of Strat, so they were already rigging their horses. "You don't need to tell us," said Sonny nervously. "You'll make sure we're secure, right? If it were a matter of our safety, you'd find a way to warn us, right?" Strat looked at the girls sympathetically when he reiterated, "I wish I could tell you, I really do." Without any more words, he jogged across the large barn to the far end and started getting his horse ready. Dilly and Sonny watched for a few seconds and then turned around to walk out. "Psst!" Dilly spun in surprise. Sirlonk was signaling to her, though he held one finger up to his mouth, suggesting they be quiet. "Psst!" The girls walked over and stood by Sirlonk's horse. "What is it?" whispered Dilly. "I think it's dreadful that they intend on keeping the two of you out of the loop," said Sirlonk quietly. "It's not right, so I'll tell you, but I expect you'll maintain tight lips." Dilly and Sonny nodded their heads and leaned in to hear the news. Bamboo told Uke his journey plans before he left. He anticipated being back 2 days ago and said that if he weren't home by dinner today, Uke should send out a search party. Something was surely wrong. So here we are heading off to find out why Bamboo hasn't returned. Tinja led his horse down the middle of the barn, heading for Sirlonk, which caused a quick change in the volume and content of the conversation. "I'm sorry, girls. As I just said," grumbled Sirlonk in a loud and seemingly annoyed voice, "I can't tell you any more than Strat just did. Uke made us promise, and that means something to me." Sirlonk winked at the end for Dilly and Sonny to see, before mounting his horse. "Are you about done?" hollered Tinja to Strat. "I'm coming," he bellowed back. "I may be slow on a horse, but I can rig one in a flippy." Moments later, after watching the horsemen disappear out of sight, Dilly and Sonny broke into tears. They went back into the barn and hid behind Song, sitting upon a pile of freshly cut grass. With the new information that Bamboo was possibly in trouble, neither of them had a sufficient appetite to finish eating dinner. And having nodded to Sirlonk that they would keep the news a secret made things difficult. If they went back inside while crying, people would want to know why. Finally, hours later, when the sun began to set and there was still no sign of Bamboo, the two girls marched inside the castle and went to bed early. On their way, however, just as they had forecast, Boot, Buck, and Dot all tried to find out what was wrong. Yet to their bedroom door and inside, they refused to speak a word of what distressed them, other than to frankly state through their tears that something felt misplaced. A heavier-than-usual darkness cloaked the castle. Boot, Buck, and Dodd sensed it, even though none of them said anything about it until around midnight, when the boys were preparing for bed. Boot was the first to speak up. "I think Dilly's right," he said. "Something is misplaced or wrong. I don't know what it is, but there's a bad feeling about tonight. What do you think, Buck?"
"Same."
"What about you, Dodd?" asked Boot, giving him a nudge.
"Yeah, I feel it, too. So what should we do?"
"Go to sleep and forget about it, I guess," said Boot. "There's not much we can do in the middle of the night, especially with Drat troops patrolling like they are."
Dodd walked to the window and looked out. He saw in the distance 5 little flashes, torches in the night, riding toward the barns.
"We've got company," he said. "I can't tell who it is. Come take a look."
Boot and Buck dimmed the lights in the room and moved to the window next to Dodd.
"You're right," said Boot, straining his eyes. "I wonder who would be coming to Twistyard at this time of night."
"When was Bamboo expected to return?" asked Buck.
"That's true," admitted Boot, interpreting Buck's question to be a suggestion of the riders' identities.
Maybe he is coming in late with Zerny and Jib, and those friends from Highgate's border town, in order to be here for tomorrow's celebration.
Bomboo wouldn't ride on a moonless night, said Dodd. It has to be someone else. Let's go find out who.
Are you kidding? Asked Buck. We'll never make it past the drats in the hall.
We don't need to, replied Dodd. He walked out of the bedroom for a moment, then returned, hefting a large coil of rope. That hall closet has a lot of neat stuff.
Out the window, groaned Buck.
We're only 50 feet up, if that, argued Dodd. Besides, since the drats relocated their tents, our part of the wall is somewhat hidden from their view. We'll be fine in the shadows.
Dodd tied one end of the rope to his heavy oak bed frame and dropped the rest out the window.
You can stay here if you want, but I'm going, said Dodd, slipping his shoes on his feet and a black cloak over his pajamas. It'll only take me a couple of minutes. I'll be right back. In a flash, Dodd disappeared out the window.
Boot fidgeted back and forth, watching him descend the rope to the ground. Shrouded by darkness, Dodd was barely visible.
I guess I'll go with him, said Boot sportingly. He walked over to his bed and sat down to put on his shoes. Someone needs to keep an eye on that kid. Besides, I haven't put my pajamas on yet.
When Boot noticed Buck's apprehension, he added firmly, You stay here and pull the rope up once I'm down, and when we come back, lower the rope. Savvy?
I'll watch for you, sighed Buck, relieved that he had been given an easy out.
By the time Boot finished getting ready to enter the night, Dodd was gone, and even after he descended the rope, there was still no sign of him.
Dodd, whispered Boot, walking quietly in the direction of the barns. Dodd, where are you?
A rustling sound drew Boot's attention, veering him off his original course.
What are you doing over here? He said quietly, approaching someone who was seated by a thicket of bushes.
Who's there? Said a grumpy drat soldier, lighting his candle and drawing his sword.
Boot turned to run when his foot sunk into an unusually muddy spot, sending him to the ground. He hit his face with the top part of his cloak and started crawling. However, the voice of the grumpy soldier insisting he stop or be skewered was convincing enough that he obeyed.
Who are you? Said the drat, approaching Boot. Speak up right now.
But before Boot could answer, the light went out and a scuffling sound ensued.
Run! Run! Get up and run! Said Dodd.
He had surprised the soldier from behind, ambushing him. With one hand, he had taken the soldier's light and snuffed it out, and with his other, he had swiped the soldier's sword. Of course, it was easier than it might have been. The poor young drat, keeping a lonely night watch, had been dozing off near the hedge and wasn't fully with himself, so the surprise disarmament sent him running rather than fighting.
There goes our top-notch guard, whispered Dodd.
He set the sword and candle on the ground next to the drat's overcloak.
I'm sure he'll be back in a hurry, complained Boot, staggering to his feet.
I know, responded Dodd, but when the soldiers return with him, they'll find his sword and candle nicely positioned right here with his cloak. Don't you think it will indicate a wild dream rather than loose bandits?
Maybe, agreed Boot hesitantly. Either way, let's split from here.
At the entrance to one of the barns, Dodd and Boot hid in a large hedge, eavesdropping on the conversation of the men inside.
I still can't believe it, said one of the men. It was Zerny's voice.
Well, we did everything we could.
And we're just lucky to have escaped with our own lives, said Jib.
Dodd and Boot looked at each other. The incident Zerny and Jib were discussing sounded fascinating, even if the men were no longer a mystery.
You were right, whispered Dodd to Boot. It's just Bomboo and his men. I guess I should have listened to you and we wouldn't be in this mess.
He directed Boot's eyes to the area where they had encountered the drat soldier. There were at least 50 torches burning. It looked like the men were searching the whole region, bushes and all, including right below where Buck was waiting to drop the rope for the reentry.
That's fine, joked Boot. You'll learn to believe me. I'm usually right.
A few of the torches in the distance stopped meandering and headed straight for Dodd and Boot.
We'd better dig down, groaned Boot quietly. He shuffled back and forth in the hedge, getting as low to the ground as he could, and when he couldn't lay flatter, he proceeded to push dead leaves on top of himself.
It looks as if you've done this before, whispered Dodd.
Lots of times. I've learned that hedges like this are thick enough to hide a person unless someone's looking. If you're not down like a worm, you get caught.
Dodd mimicked Boot's actions, and the two became virtually invisible. Shortly thereafter, drat forces surrounded the bush, standing on the dirt roadway in front of the barn doors.
Jib, we're glad to see you've returned, said a drat soldier, positioned only a few feet from Boot's nose.
6 other soldiers accompanied him. Boot and Dodd hid so deep in the leaves that they could barely see the outline of the men's boots well enough to count numbers.
"I wish we had better news," answered Jib. "Bomboo's been assassinated."
The awful words hung in the air like black storm clouds. Dodd and Boot lay motionless. They couldn't believe what they had just heard.
It was so shocking that even after all of the men had left, Dodd and Boot continued to remain still, paralyzed by those three simple words.
This was the kind of bad news that changed everything.